Blackstone Audiobooks presents Citizen of the Galaxy by Robert Heinlein. Chapter 1.
Lot 97, the auctioneer announced. A boy.
The boy was dizzy and half sick from the feel of ground underfoot. The slave ship had come more than 40 light years. It carried in its holds the stink of all slave ships, a reek of crowded unwashed bodies, of fear and vomit and ancient grief. Yet in it the boy had been someone, a recognized member of a group. Entitled to his meal each day, entitled to fight for his right to eat it in peace. He had even had friends. Now he was again nothing and nobody, again about to be sold. A lot had been knocked down on the auction block, matched blonde girls, alleged to be twins. The bidding had been brisk, the price high. The auctioneer turned with a smile of satisfaction and pointed at the boy.
Lot 97. Shove him up here.
The boy was cuffed and prodded onto the block, stood tense, while his feral eyes darted around, taking in what he had not been able to see from the pen. The slave market lies on the spaceport side of the famous Plaza of Liberty, facing the hill crowned by the still more famous Presidium of Sargon, capital of the Nine Worlds. The boy did not recognize it. He did not even know what planet he was on. He looked at the crowd. Closest to the slave block were beggars, ready to wheedle each buyer as he claimed his property. Beyond them, in a semicircle, were seats for the rich and privileged. On each flank of this elite group waited their slaves, bearers, and bodyguards and drivers, idling near the ground cars of the rich and the palanquins and sedan chairs of the still richer. Behind the lords and ladies were commoners, idlers and curious. Freedmen and pickpockets and vendors of cold drinks, an occasional commoner merchant not privileged to sit but alert for a bargain, and a porter, a clerk, a mechanic, or even a house servant for his wives.
Lot 97, the auctioneer repeated. A fine, healthy lad, suitable as page or tireboy. Imagine him, my lords and ladies, in the livery of your house. Look at the...
His words were lost in the scream of a ship dopplering in at the spaceport behind him. The old beggar, Baslam the Cripple, twisted his half-naked body and squinted his one eye over the edge of the block. The boy did not look like a docile house servant to Baslam. He looked a hunted animal, dirty, skinny, and bruised. Under the dirt, the boy's back showed white scar streaks, endorsements of former owner's opinions. The boy's eyes and the shape of his ears caused Baslam to guess that he might be of unmutated Earth ancestry, but not much could be certain, save that he was small, scared, male, and still defiant. The boy caught the beggar staring at him and glared back. The din died out, and a wealthy dandy, seated in front, waved a kerchief lazily at the auctioneer.
Don't waste our time, you rascal. Show us something like that last lot. Please, noble sir, I must dispose of the lots in the catalogue order.
Then get on with it, or cuff that starved varmint aside and show us merchandise.
You are kind, my lord.
The auctioneer raised his voice.
I have been asked to be quick, and I am sure my noble employer would agree. Let me be frank. This beautiful lad is young. His new owner must invest instruction in him. Therefore...
The boy hardly listened. He knew only a smattering of this language, and what was said did not matter anyhow. He looked over the veiled ladies and elegant men, wondering which one would be his new problem.
A low starting price, and a quick turnover. A bargain! Do I hear 20 stellas.
The silence grew awkward.
A lady, sleek and expensive, from sandaled feet to lace-veiled face, leaned toward the dandy, whispered and giggled.
He frowned, took out a dagger, and pretended to groom his nails.
I said to get on with it, he growled.
The auctioneer sighed.
I beg you to remember, gentle folk, that I must answer to my patron. But we'll start still lower. 10 stellas. Yes, I said 10, huh? Fantastic.
He looked amazed.
Am I growing deaf? Did someone lift a finger, and I fail to see it? Consider, I beg you. Here you have a fresh, young lad, like a clean sheet of paper. You can draw any design you like. At this unbelievably low price, you can afford to make a mute of him, or alter him as your fancy pleases.
Or feed him to the fish.
Or feed him... You are witty, noble sir.
I'm bored. What makes you think that sorry item is worth anything? Your son, perhaps?
The auctioneer forced a smile.
I would be proud if he were. I wish I were permitted to tell you this lad's ancestry.
Which means you don't know.
Though my lips must be sealed, I can point out the shape of his skull, the perfectly rounded curve of his ears.
The auctioneer nipped the boy's ear, pulled it. The boy twisted and bit his hand. The crowd laughed. The man snatched his hand away.
A spirited lad. Nothing a taste of a leather won't cure. Good stock. Look at his ears. The best in the galaxy, some say.
The auctioneer had overlooked something. The young dandy was from Sindon 4. He removed his helmet, uncovering typical Sindonian ears, long, hairy, and pointed. He leaned forward, and his ears twitched.
Who is your noble protector?
The old beggar Baslam scooted near the corner of the block, ready to duck. The boy tensed and looked around, aware of trouble without understanding why. The auctioneer went white. No one sneered at Sindonians face to face. Not more than once.
My lord, he gasped, you misunderstood me.
Repeat that crack about ears and the best stock.
Police were in sight, but not close. The auctioneer wet his lips.
A bit gracious, a gentle lord. My children would starve. I quoted a common saying, not my opinion. I was trying to hasten the bid for this chattel, as you yourself urged.
The silence was broken by a female voice saying,
"Oh, let him go, Dwarrel. It's not his fault how the slave's ears are shaved. He has to sell him."
The Sindonian breathed heavily.
"Sell him, then."
The auctioneer took a breath.
Yes, my lord.
He pulled himself together and went on.
I beg my lord's and the lady's pardons for wasting time on a minor lot. I now ask for any bid at all.
He waited, said nervously.
I hear no bid. I see no bid. No bid once. If you do not bid, I am required to return this lot to stock and consult my patron before continuing. No bid twice. There are many beautiful items to be offered. It would be a shame not to show them. No bid three.
There's your bid, the Sindonian said.
Eh?
The old beggar was holding up two fingers. The auctioneer stared.
Are you offering a bid?
Yes, croaked the old man, if the lords and ladies permit.
The auctioneer glanced at the seated circle. Someone in the crowd shouted,
Why not? Money is money.
The Sindonian nodded. The auctioneer said quickly,
You offer 2 stellas for this boy.
No,
Baslam screamed.
2 minims.
The auctioneer kicked at him. The beggar jerked his head aside. The auctioneer shouted, "Get out! I teach you to make fun of your betters." "Auctioneer?"
Sir, yes, my lord.
The Sindonian said, "Your words were any bit at all. Sell him the boy."
But you
heard me.
My lord, I cannot sell on one bid. The law is clear. One bid is not an auction. Nor even two, unless the auctioneer has set a minimum. With no minimum, I am not allowed to sell with less than three bids. Noble sir, this law was given to protect the owner, not my unhappy self.
Someone shouted, "That's the law!" The Sindonian frowned. "Then declare the bid."
"Whatever pleases my lords and ladies."
He faced the crowd.
"For lot 97, I hear a bid of two minimums. Who'll make it four?"
"Four," stated the Sindonian.
"Five,"
a voice called out. The Sindonian motioned the beggar to him. Baslam moved on hands and one knee, with the stump of the other leg dragging, and was hampered by his alms bowl. The auctioneer started droning,
"Going at the five minimums once, five minimums twice."
"Six," snapped the Sindonian, glanced into the beggar's bowl, reached in his purse, and threw him a handful of change.
"I hear a six. Do I hear a seven?"
"Seven,"
croaked Baslam.
"I am a bid seven. You, over there, with your thumb up, you make it eight?"
"Nine,"
interposed the beggar. The auctioneer glared, but put the bid. The price was approaching one stellar, too expensive a joke for most of the crowd. The lords and ladies neither wanted the worthless slave nor wished to queer the Sindonian's jest. The auctioneer chanted,
"Going once at nine, going twice at nine, going three times, sold at nine minimums."
He shoved the boy off the block almost into the beggar's lap.
"Take him and get out."
"Softly," cautioned the Sindonian. "The bill of sale." Restraining himself, the auctioneer filled in price and new owner on a form already prepared for lot 97. Baslam paid over nine minimums, then had to be subsidized again by the Sindonian, as the stamp tax was more than the selling price. The boy stood quietly by. He knew that he had been sold again, and he was getting it through his head that the old man was his new master. Not that it mattered, he wanted neither of them. While all were busy with the tax, he made a break. Without appearing to look, the old beggar made a long arm, snagged an ankle, pulled him back. Then Baslam heaved himself erect, placed an arm across the boy's shoulders, and used him for a crutch. The boy felt a bony hand clutch his elbow in a strong grip, and relaxed himself to the inevitable another time. They always got careless if you waited. Supported, the beggar bowed with great dignity.
"My lord," he said huskily, "I and my servant thank you."
"Nothing." "Nothing." The Sindonian flourished his kerchief in dismissal. From the Plaza of Liberty to the hole where Baslam lived was less than a li, no more than a half mile. But it took them longer than such distance implies. The hopping progress the old man could manage using the boy as one leg was even slower than his speed on two hands and one knee, and it was interrupted frequently by rests for business. Not that business ceased while they shuffled along, as the old man required the boy to thrust the bowl under the nose of every pedestrian. Baslam accomplished this without words. He had tried interlingua, space Dutch, Sarganese, half a dozen forms of patois, thieves' kitchen, cant, slave lingo, and trade talk, even system English, without result, although he suspected that the boy had understood him more than once. Then he dropped the attempt and made his wishes known by sign language, and a cuff or two. If the boy and he had no words in common, he would teach him. All in good time. All in good time. Baslam was in no hurry. Baslam was never in a hurry. He took the long view. Vaslin's home lay under the old amphitheater. When Sargon Augustus of Imperial memory decreed a larger circus, only part of the old one was demolished. The work was interrupted by the Second Cetan War and never resumed. Vaslin led the boy into these ruins. The going was rough, and it was necessary for the old man to resume crawling, but he never let go his grip. Once he had the boy only by breech clout, the boy almost wriggled out of his one bit of clothing before the beggar snatched a wrist. After that, they went more slowly. They went down a hole at the dark end of a ruined passage, the boy being forced to go first. They crawled over shards and rubble, and came into a night-black but smooth corridor. Down again, and they were in the performers' barracks of the old amphitheater, under the old arena. They came in the dark to a well-carpentered door. Vaslin shoved the boy through, followed him and closed it, pressed his thumb to a personal lock, touched a switch, light came on.
"Well, lad, we're home."
The boy stared. Long ago he had given up having expectations of any sort, but what he saw was not anything he could have expected. It was a modest, decent, small living room, tight, neat, and clean. Ceiling panels gave pleasant, glareless light. Furniture was sparse but adequate. The boy looked around in awe. Poor as it was better than anything he remembered having lived in. The beggar let go his shoulder, hopped to a stack of shelves, put down his bowl, and took up a complicated something. It was not until the beggar shucked his clout and strapped the thing in place that the boy figured out what it was. An artificial leg, so well articulated that it rivaled the efficiency of flesh and blood. The man stood up, took trousers from a chest, drew them on, and hardly seemed crippled.
"Come here,"
he said in interlingua. The boy did not move. Vaslin repeated it in other languages, shrugged, took the boy by an arm, led him into a room beyond. It was small, both kitchen and washroom. Vaslin filled a pan, handed the boy a bit of soap, and said,
"Take a bath."
He pantomimed what he wanted. The boy stood in mute stubbornness. The man sighed, picked up a brush suitable for floors, and started as if to scrub the boy. He stopped, with stiff bristles touching skin, and repeated,
"Take a bath. Wash yourself."
Saying it in interlingua, and system English. The boy hesitated, took off his clout, and started slowly to lather himself. Vaslin said,
"That's better."
Picked up the filthy breech clout, dropped it in a waste can, laid out a towel, and, turning to the kitchen side, started preparing a meal. A few minutes later he turned, and the boy was gone. Unhurriedly he walked into the living room, found the boy, naked and wet, and trying very hard to open the door. The boy saw him, but redoubled his futile efforts. Vaslin tapped him on the shoulder, hooked a thumb toward the smaller room.
"Finish your bath."
He turned away. The boy slunk after him. When the boy was washed and dry, Vaslin put the stew he had been freshening back on the burner, turned the switch to simmer, and opened a cupboard, from which he removed a bottle and daubs of vegetable flock. Clean, the boy was a pattern of scars and bruises, unhealed sores and cuts and abrasions, old and new.
Hold still.
The stuff stung. The boy started to wiggle.
Hold still,
Vaslin repeated, in a pleasant, firm tone, and slapped him. The boy relaxed, tensing only as the medicine touched him. The man looked carefully at an old ulcer on the boy's knee, then, humming softly, went again to the cupboard, came back and injected the boy in one buttock, first acting out the idea that he would slap his head off his shoulders if he failed to take it quietly. That done, he found an old cloth, motioned the boy to wrap himself a clout, turned back to his cooking. Presently Vaslin placed big bowls of stew on the table in the living room, first moving chair and table, so that the boy might sit on the chest while eating. He added a handful of fresh green lentils and a couple of generous chunks of country bread, black and hard.
"Sit down, lad. Come and get it."
The boy sat down on the edge of the chest, but remained poised for flight, and did not eat. Vaslin stopped eating.
"What's the matter?"
He saw the boy's eyes flick toward the door, then drop.
"Oh,
so that's it.
He got up, steadying himself, to get his false leg under him, went to the door, pressed his thumb in the lock.
He faced the boy.
The door is unlocked,
he announced.
Either eat your dinner, or leave.
He repeated it several ways, and was pleased when he thought that he detected understanding, on using the language he surmised might be the slave's native tongue. But he let the matter rest, went back to the table, got carefully into his chair, and picked up his spoon. The boy reached for his own, then suddenly was off the chest and out the door. Baslam went on eating. The door remained ajar, light streaming into the labyrinth. Later, when Baslam had finished a leisurely dinner, he became aware that the boy was watching him from the shadows.
He avoided looking, lounged back, and started picking his teeth.
Without turning, he said in the language he had decided might be the boy's own,
"Will you come eat your dinner, or shall I throw it away?"
The boy did not answer.
"All right," Baslam went on. "If you won't, I'll have to close the door. I can't risk leaving it open with the light on."
He slowly got up, went to the door, and started to close it.
"Last call," he announced. "Closing up for the night."
As the door was almost closed, the boy squealed, "Wait!" in the language Baslam expected, and scurried inside.
"Welcome,"
Baslam said quietly.
"I'll leave it unlocked in case you change your mind."
He sighed.
"If I had my way, no one would ever be locked in."
The boy did not answer, but sat down, huddled himself over the food, and began wolfing it, as if afraid it might be snatched away. His eyes flicked from right to left. Baslam sat down and watched. The extreme pace slowed, but chewing and gulping never ceased until the last bit of stew had been chased with the last hunk of bread, the last lentil crunched and swallowed.
The final bites appeared to go down by sheer willpower, but swallow them he did, sat up, looked Baslam in the eye, and smiled shyly. Baslam smiled back. The boy's smile vanished. He turned white, then a light green. A rope of drool came willy-nilly from a corner of his mouth, and he was disastrously sick. Baslam moved to avoid the explosion.
"Stars in heaven, I'm an idiot,"
he exclaimed, in his native language. He went into the kitchen, returned with rags and pail, wiped the boy's face, and told him sharply to quiet down, then cleaned the stone floor. After a bit he returned with a much smaller ration, only broth and a small piece of bread.
"Salt the bread and eat it."
I better not.
"Eat it. You won't be sick again. I should have known better, seeing your belly against your backbone, than to give you a man-sized meal. But eat slowly."
The boy looked up and his chin quivered. Then he took a small spoonful. Baslam watched while he finished the broth and most of the bread.
"Good,"
Baslam said at last.
"Well, I'm for bed, lad. Eh? By the way, what's your name?"
The boy hesitated.
"Thorby."
"Thorby. A good name. You can call me Pop. Good night."
He unstrapped his leg, hopped to the shelf and put it away, hopped to his bed. It was a peasant bed, a hard mattress in a corner. He scrunched close to the wall to leave room for the boy and said,
"Put out the light before you come to bed."
Then he closed his eyes and waited. There was a long silence. He heard the boy go to the door. The light went out. Baslam waited, listening for the noise of the door opening. It did not come. Instead, he felt the mattress give as the boy crawled in.
"Good night," he repeated.
"Good night."
He had almost dozed when he realized that the boy was trembling violently. He reached behind him, felt skinny ribs, patted them. The boy broke into sobs. He turned over, eased his stump into a comfortable position, put an arm around the boy's shaking shoulders, and pulled his face against his own chest.
"It's all right, Thorby,"
he said gently.
"It's all right. It's over now. It'll never happen again."
The boy cried out loud and clung to him. Baslam held him, speaking softly, until the spasms stopped. Then he held still until he was sure that Thorby was asleep.